continue with questions and answers, so Ms. Kennedy, and I just want to apologize for our schedule being a little out of whack today, but you know, it's hard to stop a guy that has so much information.
What are we, anyway? One feels in deeply to the sense of the body. You'll open it up. It'll just turn into an energy field.
Yeah.
You feel deeply into your emotions, including the so-called unwholesome emotions, sinful emotions. Just feel deeply into them. What are they? They're made out of energy. God's aliveness, power in us, and it gets kind of fragmented off as my anger or my fear or my rage or jealousy or pettiness or mindless euphoria. Feel into every stage. You find some great message I said, if you really go deep and explore whatever shows up, whatever creature or phenomenon shows up, you'll find God, because God is the creator of all phenomena, the source of them, the power by which they can exist at all. The same way at the level of the mind. Have so many concepts about God, about us, about society, politics, religion. But what is a thought? Have you ever just felt into a thought? Like, I love Democrats. Right? I love Republicans. Come on, sing. I support for that thought. What is a thought? Feel into it deeply. Where do thoughts come from? What's the power that powers thoughts, by which you have thoughts, host thoughts, entertain thoughts, subject to thoughts, hopefully wholesome thoughts? And then what is the sense of the me, the person, the soul? I've taken in recent years to calling this the viewpoint, because it's so obvious. It's the one alone, the one divine Father, Mother, Source, I Am, That Himself, has sourced all of us into being, gazillions of beings throughout the cosmos, each one with a sense of being a distinct, unique viewpoint on the cosmos, a subject of certain experiences for this one, whereas our neighbor is the subject for another set of experiences. But if we feel all the way deeply into, well, what is this viewpoint itself? That also will open up, and you find out, as Meister Eckhart said, real Eckhart, 700 years ago, said, the eye by which I see God is the eye by which God sees me. He had these wonderful other juicy things, that God is at home right here at the center. God is at home. Man is abroad. Out there in the mind, thinking about theology and Protestants and Catholics and Eastern Orthodox or those indigenous and Buddhists. Now, what is it to live from right here? The here that turns out being wide open and boundless, omnipresent. God's here. Inquiry this way opens up that deep, intuitive, mystic sageliness. The true Gnostic kind of spirituality that Jesus models for us in the Gospel of Thomas. I just have to finish up a little bit here, but it didn't go before the break. Because my old friend Stephen Davies did the yeoman scholarly work to show that the Gospel of Thomas is as early, if not earlier, as early an authentic saying source of Jesus as is that so-called Quella source text, the Book of Q. You know, the Jesus Seminar of scholars like Marcus Borg and some of Burton Mack and everyone that analyzed so much. Stephen Davies showed that the Gospel of Thomas sings, many of which, not all of which, but many of which can then be found in the Gospel of Mark, our first narrative gospel, that has the narrative basis for what then Matthew and Luke use as their narrative about Jesus. And because they integrated the Book of Q became irrelevant anymore. No one wanted to copy that book because it didn't have a narrative with it. All the sayings had already been reproduced in Matthew Gospel and the Luke Gospel, so they copied those Gospels. They didn't copy the Q text source, which was a book floating around. We have no idea how many copies. 3 copies? 10? 50? But we know it existed because the sayings in the Matthew and Luke Gospels are too verbatim the same, the sayings attributed to Jesus. So we know there was a saying source, a Q text. There was this Gospel of Thomas, or a Thomasine community of Christians, just like there was a Markan community and a Luke community and a Johannine, John Gospel community of early Christians. And they valued and treasured certain sayings, remembered deeds, forms of inspiration from their good rabbi Jesus, their great inspiration, the one who seemed like God-man to them. And the Thomasine community of Christianity has this saying source, and that will be your window onto a mystical, inner mystical kind of spirituality. For instance, there's a passage I always love to quote. The disciples come to Jesus. They're obsessed, as most people were then and today. You find a lot of this obsession in evangelical, right-wing evangelical Christianity, and in the New Age movement. This apocalyptic sense of like human beings thinking themselves to be a little entity in time and space. As they look out on the temporal timeline into the future, they wonder what's coming ahead. Great changes, 2012. A buddy of mine, Tom Rossetto, has completely reframed the original intention of the Mayan about 2012 and 2012. And it's all very positive. It's none of this doomsday stuff that people have been. And all the panic mongering and fear mongering. Thomas Rossetto, R-A-Z, so two Z's and one T. He comes a lot to our Tuesday night spiritual gathering. I host a free spiritual gathering on deep mystical realization. Great. Meets in private homes, so contact me and get you the address. Anyway, the apocalyptic sensibility looks out into the future on the timeline and wonders, when is going to be the last judgment? When is Armageddon? Apocalyptic-oriented people are very interested in what's coming in future time. But that same mentality was around Jesus at his time. And so it's said in the Gospel of Thomas, one of the sayings, the disciples came to Jesus and asked him when the end would come, what would be the signs? And Jesus says, have you discovered the beginning? Then you can now ask about the end. For there where the beginning is, there the end shall be. Meaning in the timeless is the source of all time. And then he says, blessed is he or she who takes or finds him or herself in the beginning before they came into being. Now this is Jesus, the Zen master. The intuitive mystic sage who knows the divine reality that he lives from, that all of us live from, in whom we live, move, and have our being, insofar as we're persons, processes, body, mind, soul processes, we live, move, and have our being in this timeless, spaceless, boundless, changeless, purely transcendent God, God who is pure spirit, must be worshipped in spirit and in truth. Where is God? Right here, closer than your own mind. On the near end of seeing, on the near end of feelings. It's what you are, whether the body-mind is in the so-called waking state, the dream state, the dreamless sleep state, as our most ancient Upanishad said, the one who is before and beyond the three states. Turiya, literally the fourth. And Turiya Atita, even beyond the witness, the absolute. So if we fully feel into, get really curious and sincere about how is it that God is in my neighbor and also right in myself? The eye by which God sees me is the eye by which I see myself or see God, as my story card says. What is it to live from the center, from the core, from right here? Remember, the journey is from here to here.
We also live in societies and in cultures, and so it's not just us and God, it's us and our neighborhood.
Precisely.
But there's a give and take there. How do we, this is not quite as pure, in a sense.
I say it's all pure.
Well,
here's the secret. It's a great question, Anne, because see, if Jesus, when asked the great command, great commandment, had only said, love the Lord thy God with thy entire soul, heart, mind, and strength, and left it at that, you have people all very contemplative, inward, yogi types, introverted, the poor extroverts would feel left out. They could never quite get in touch with their introverted sense, you know. But Jesus shared the full teaching. Not just the transcendent God, but the God who is immanent as the heart of everyone and everything. And he gave the corollary, and love thy neighbor as thyself. God is the I am that am self, the true I within every me.
But when you truly realize... but is there a collective...
Well, I was just going to say, and again, I'm glad you spoke out on that, because when you realize the pure I of mystic spirituality, it automatically explodes, silently, gently explodes open as the I that is we. And the transcendent spirituality becomes fully immanent. And that's where you get a good and balanced panentheism. No mere pantheism that says God is nothing more than nature and the sum of the parts. Or a mere theism that just sticks God up there. And then it's like, well, where is God here? And it's kind of in line with your question. How do we live this in a social way? Inclusively. And so, panentheism, all in God, God in all, it's not an old word as far as words or terms go, like apokatastasis, which is a real ancient word, and kenosis, which is a real ancient word that's self-emptying. But it's clearly what Jesus is speaking about when he's talking about this domain of God, this basileia de theos, and other lines in the Gospel of Thomas, for instance, when he talks about, you know, split a piece of wood, I am there. Lift a rock, I am there. And you make the male as the female and the inner as the outer and so forth. Those are all imminent kind of divine intimations, teachings, suggestions, invitations to realize that your own transcendent divine nature, pure, pure spirit, is so transcendent that it can fully form as all these bodies and minds with their opinions and people with their conditioning and the tensions and conflicts of the world's conflict, literally meaning beings being thrown together with their differences. Conflict means being thrown together with our differences, our different values, our different histories and conditionings. Some want kind of vanilla ice cream for dessert, and others want chocolate. And some, you know, it's like husbands, wives, again, the arguments, you know. He wants to go to Yosemite and she wants to go to Hawaii. Okay, we'll go to Hawaii. Let's take, you know, a snorkeling cruise out there on the little island. She goes, no, let's go shopping. Or vice versa. The guy wants to go shopping. And,
you know,
so.
Yeah, let's
go to. Yes, dear, what's your name?
Anna.
Anna.
I was intrigued in the beginning of this chapter by the professor that threw Albert Schweitzer out the window.
Yeah, Schweitzer, Albert Schweitzer summed up about, 180 or 200 years of biblical scholarship. At first it was happening in little dribs and drabs, fits and starts, because you could be burnt at the stake as a heretic for raising some of the questions that were being raised in the 1700s, even 1600s, by certain people reading the Bible. What began to happen, certain German theologians, scholars, began to read the Gospels in parallel. They didn't just read through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They started sticking the Matthew Gospel next to the Mark Gospel, next to the Luke Gospel, next to the John Gospel, reading them in parallel. Well, it's like, oh, why is that story of the miracle of Cana, the wedding feast, Cana, only in the John Gospel? You know, what about when Jesus was transfigured, when the apostles were up there, a few select disciples were up there on the mountain with him, where they got into real confusion and troubles when they started looking at the passion, crucifixion, and especially the post-crucifixion tales that were being told. There's all these contradictions. Mm-hmm. And how do we square all this? How can we be literalists when it seems like we got to pick and choose because they're literally contradicting each other? in terms of like, who was the first person to see Jesus after the crucifixion? And was it a bodily appearance or more like a spirit body, as Paul called it? If you study new physics, you'll know there's all sorts of interdimensional powers, and it'd be very easy for a soul, having been killed in a crucifixion, to manifest dense physical, palpable, tangible bodily presence, such as a disciple Thomas might be able to stick his finger into the wound of Jesus had he manifested through the power of a miracle working divine inspired and empowered mind. He could create what they call in the East a mind created body, and it would have physical properties. It would be palpable. You could hug that body, you could hear his voice, see it very clearly, not just kind of a ghostly apparition. So a couple hundred years before Schweitzer, some courageous Germans started exploring and pointing out, hey guys, you know, I hate to say this, but there's differences here that we can't reconcile. And they began to use incipient literary criticism methods. In fact, they helped birth the field of literary criticism, historical literary criticism. And other techniques came in as scholars began to work more with the ancient Semitic and Mediterranean languages to figure out, you know, what were these different Christian communities trying to say with their texts? And one community would have like the Luke Gospel as their main text. They came up with it. And the compilers of the Luke Gospel, it wasn't just some guy, Luke, sat down and writes out this little thing. It seems like there are different streams inputting into it, different minds at work to compile this. And so Schweitzer, he didn't really put in that much that was original. He just summed up what had gone before. But the summary statement was so kind of blunt and shocking that a lot of traditionalists, literalists, and others, it's like, don't upset our apple cart, our plastic Jesus. I mean, we've worked him out theologically. We've created this model of Jesus over, you know, especially since like the Council of Nicaea, the Nicene Creed and so forth. We don't want anyone messing with us on that. And that's why he got flack. Well, it's often said that Schweitzer's summary statement ended the so-called first modern quest for the historical Jesus. There was a second quest that was ushered in. You know, people like Rudolf Bultmann and other Protestant theologians and others, a number of Catholic scholars were working. They created the so-called second historical quest that pretty much fizzled out by the time of the God is Dead movement of the 50s and 60s. Plus Paul Tillich, some of his theology was putting an end to some of that questing. But then the Jesus Seminar started ushering in the third quest. They just had access to better methods and more archaeological discoveries, bringing in more Jewish scholars so we could get better scholarship, because Jesus was Jewish. All of his colleagues were Jewish. So bringing in Jewish sensibilities to it. Also doing some work to heal the anti-Semitism that crept into Christian tradition. Not just those anti-Pharisee bashing statements put into the mouth of Jesus in the Matthew Gospel, but, you know, like in the John Gospel, the version of how did Pontius Pilate decide on, you know, liberating Barabbas but having Jesus executed. It's a very anti-Semitic thing, as people like John Dominic Crossan and others have pointed out, where Jews became the Christ killers. And Hitler used that line over and over as one of his excuses for, you know, the final solution, exterminating the Jews of Europe, wherever he could find them. He would say, just in case anyone thought that was being, you know, beyond the pale or, you know, over the edge, he'd say, well, they are, after all, the Christ killers. Mm-hmm. So, one of these days I am going to write a book on Jesus. I've got massive notes and several of the chapters written and everything. I was actually trying to open it last night and realized I wrote it in a scholar's font that my new computer won't open. So I got to talk to the guy that created the font. But because I used to dialogue a lot with New Testament scholars. When the internet came along in 1995, it's one of the first things I wanted to do is see if I could access a lot of these New Testament scholars and really pick their brains to find out what they knew and the limit of their knowledge. And what I've concluded is that the only way you can really understand Jesus is by becoming a great mystic yourself and opening up to the power of the Spirit and seeing what kind of prophetic ministry might come through if you truly lose your life for the everlasting divine life. And whether your way is deep, deep, profound, beyond relaxation, Hezekiah, pure stillness, as the early desert Christian fathers and mothers. We know there were more desert mothers than desert fathers. They outnumbered them 2-1 to Palladius and other visitors to the upper deserts of Egypt. Or it's through, you know, a social ministry and losing your life in service, like, you know, the Catholic workers, Dorothy Day, Father Peter Moran, and, you know, Mother Teresa of Calcutta's missionaries of charity. So whatever your way is, a more extroverted, engaged spirituality, that inner mystical spirituality, hopefully a nice balance of both. Feeling the inner transcendence, but God imminent within and as everyone. So, you know, you don't feel like God's up there and all those people are like out there worldly, not godly, they're interfering with my spirituality. That's not spiritual.
I was just thinking to myself about my own evolution with regard to Jesus.
That's true.
I grew up in the beginning with the Word, and the Word was with God. It was the mystical Jesus, the Jesus of John's prologue. And later on, it became very important to me to find Jesus' humanity. And of course, it was the Jesus seminar that helped me to do that.
Yeah,
you know, I read them, and my gosh, you know, this is Jesus the man.
Yeah.
And now, my thinking is a bit what you were saying, that to know the Jesus, you have to become a mystic to really know who he is.
And if it helps, and that's what the main theme would be in terms of the scholarly methodology, the book I have in the works on Jesus, study other mystics about whom we have very good records and even autobiographical writings. And you start to get the whole value system and way of perceiving, way of doing theology, formally or informally, of some of the great mystics. And see, New Testament scholars are trying to go back and find out what were the socio-economic, religious, political dynamics of first century Palestine. But I submit to you that trying to find Jesus through that route.
But that was very important for
me. It was very important.
It was very important for me.
It needed to be done, and they did it.
You know, it made him one with me. I'm a human, he was a human.
But what I'm saying is, in any given locale, there's going to be humans that are opened up in a way and are living life from a context of excellence, divine excellence, spirit-powered excellence, that will not be explicable or predictable given what we know about the socioeconomic, political, religious milieu. There's an incredible holy woman of Southwest India, a little island off the southwest coast of Kerala, named Amma, the Hugging Mother. The world now knows about her because the media and the UN have given her these awards. She was the featured keynote Hindu representative in the 1993 Parliament of World Religions and so forth. You will not know anything about her life if you only study the dynamics of mid-20th century Southwest India, state of Kerala, religious, economic, political, social stratification dynamics. To actually meet her, to see this little woman, she's the one that hugs everyone. They estimate she's given like 30 million she's hugged 30 million people. Some of us have gotten hundreds of those hugs in the early years, back in the 1980s. Just her stamina is an ongoing divine miracle. No mere human being could do that. Just seeing her, as many longtime Christians, priests and nuns in India and Europe who come to see her all the time whenever she travels the world, which is every year, tirelessly, they say she is like the love of Christ in action. You can see that love on display and begin to have a sense of what that love was emanating through Jesus that the disciples were so riveted by, attracted by. I will submit to you that most of the New Testament scholars of the Jesus Seminar movement, by the time you get finished, Jesus is a nice guy, talented parable teller. Then he has this kind of politics of inclusion and, you know, the open table, as it's called. No one's left out of his table. Even publicans and sinners are allowed. In fact, he hangs out a lot with publican sinners. Not Republican sinners, but publican sinners. Democrat sinners, too. All of them are stealing. They didn't grace. All saved. So, when you read the Jesus Seminar, because these guys are academics, almost none of them have studied parapsychology, spiritual or psychic healing, all the new science, new paradigm of like chi energy, interdimensional physics, which is required by the modern superstring theory that there be these other dimensions. Almost none of them have studied other mystics. Marcus Borg has begun to dabble in this about the last 8 or 10 years. He wrote that little, very flimsy little book, you know, taking some of the teachings of the Buddha and some of the teachings of Jesus and showing parallels. Stephen Mitchell, who lives out in Ojai and is married to Byron Katie, he did a very problematic book about Jesus where he, for the first time ever, he tries to contextualize Jesus' teachings among the teachings of sages like the great Sri Ramana Maharshi of modern India, who dropped the body, as they say, in 1950. But unfortunately, Stephen Mitchell gets it all wrong in taking this story from a late Talmudic Jewish source. And by that point, Jews were being so persecuted and marginalized by Christians that they were striking back, and they were doing it a lot in their Talmud writings. You may not be aware, but ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel have taken the international addition sign, the mathematical addition sign, out of all the children's textbook because it looks like the Christian cross. It's a mitzvah, a good deed, to spit when you pass a Christian cemetery. I mean, that's how bad it was early on for the Jews, what the Christians were doing to them. Well, there's a late Talmudic source that says Jesus, for founding this new religion, is actually being cursed and punished forever by God. He's boiling forever in a vat of excrement. That's in the Talmud. I forget if it's the Bel- it's in the Jerusalem Talmud. Now, that's not what most mainstream Jews think about Jesus, but it's what a certain very hard right-wing core, and it's flourishing in Israel. It controls the swing vote, trying to get people like Bibi Netanyahu and Ariel Sharon in office over there, denying, you know, the two-state solution and so forth with the Palestinians. So we have to be aware that, you know, the words are powerful. And in the case of, you know, Jesus, certain models about him were created and they're false and misleading. Stephen Mitchell, though, in his book about Jesus, he takes that idea from the Talmud that Jesus was born the bastard son of Mary because she was raped by a Roman centurion. That's a story told in one layer of the thicket of the Talmud. And Stephen spends like 80 out of his 200 pages in his book psychologizing Jesus in the worst kind of pop psychology about Jesus' personality, because he must have been compensating for having grown up with an inferiority complex for being like this bastard, half Roman, half Jewish child. And no scholar takes that story seriously, and yet he just contaminated this whole work. So what needs to happen is a book, for the first time, that goes deeply into Jesus' teaching in context of the great mystical teachings of the East that preceded him, that could have trickled down the Silk Road and the Sea Lane maritime trade routes. There was massive trade between India and the Middle East and the Mediterranean, actually going back at least 2,000 years before Jesus. So we know it wasn't just goods, but ideas. So Jesus, there might have been teachings, like teachings about itinerancy. The Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain wanderers, that might have influenced Jesus' command to his disciples to be itinerant, you know, to wander around, relying on alms. That's actually his commandment to his core early Christians. And so we need a book that contextualizes Jesus and includes the all-important Gospel of Thomas sayings, which we know are much earlier than their parallel version in the Mark Gospel. Stephen Davies' work has been immensely important in that respect. We need that Q book set of teachings of Jesus about socially engaged, and we would say today environmentally engaged spirituality, the stewardship, creation care model. And as for his miracles, I don't think we need to throw those out the window. Almost all the Jesus seminar scholars think, really, miracles? No. We modern and postmodern people, we don't believe in miracles anymore. Well, just get on Michio Kaku's basic reader for the lay person on the modern new superstring physics. He says there would be powers available to someone whose consciousness had opened up and was accessing just one extra spatial dimension. They would have godlike powers. For instance, materializing loaves and fishes, reaching into someone's body, pulling a cancerous tumor out and just disappearing it. All sorts of miraculous powers. Michio Kaku, this great physicist, he's written a textbook on superstring theory, but he's written these more popular books for the lay public. And he says that godlike powers would be available to someone whose consciousness had just opened up and had just one extra spatial dimension available to them. So the Jesus Seminar is really great as far as it goes, carrying on the project that Albert Schweitzer was trying to summarize over 100 years ago. But they don't go far enough. Most of them are academics, they're not mystics. Most of them have never studied comparative mysticism, that is, the great lives and teachings of the great mystics, East and West, male and female. So that's another way you can begin to understand Jesus, is get thee to your bibliographies and really do some wonderful studies from the great holy people, Catholic and non-Catholic, Christian and non-Christian, from models, exemplars, and messengers of a deeper, fuller, broader, richer, and far more mystical kind of spirituality. I think we're at time.
Can I ask Tom how many of you would like to have him come back and finish?